Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley Voices of Reform program brought to you from the Santa Clara Convention Center in Silicon Valley. I'm Gloria Duffy, and I'll be your chair for this evening. The Commonwealth Club of California, with support from the James Irvine Foundation, has launched a two-year initiative to focus on ideas and strategies to implement effective reform in governance and our political system here in California. This project is based on the premise that many of the problems that gave rise to last year's gubernatorial recall are systemic flaws in our system of governance, and not just related to who is the particular occupant of the governor's office. We will be discussing ideas about change in campaign finance, drawing of districts, budget processes, funding and Prop 13 in California, the role of lobbyists, voter turnout, the initiative process, and many other systemic issues. When nationally recognized columnist and best-selling author Arianna Huffington ran as an independent in last year's recall election, she was a spark and a provocateur, but her platform also was a very serious call for change in California. Her populist grassroots campaign was a far cry from the standard model of politics, and she was widely praised for showcasing her bold ideas and focusing the media spotlight on the corrupting influences of special interest money in American politics. The recall campaign was another step in Arianna's crusade to mobilize and empower a populist movement where the American people finally take back their government and their country. Ms. Huffington has helped to organize the Shadow Convention in 2000, which coincided with the Republican Convention in Philadelphia and the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles, to put the media spotlight on three key issues that neither major party was willing to address: the way money was corrupting politics, the disparaging socioeconomic gap between Americans, and the nation's failed $40 billion a year war on drugs. Ms. Huffington also co-founded the Detroit Project, a campaign to stop manufacturing gas-guzzling SUVs, and the Bermuda Project that exposed corporate America's growing use of offshore tax havens. She serves as the national co-chair of Parents in Charge, a reform movement to our country's failing public education system, and has collaborated with public radio host Harry Shearer in his Partnership for a Poll-Free America campaign. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Arianna Huffington.
Thank you so much, Gloria, for this great introduction. And thank you for the work you're doing here. This is such an important cause. And indeed, nothing very much will change, however often we change governors and presidents, if we don't fundamentally reform what does not work in our system. And I'm going to talk about that in the course of my speech. But first of all, for those of you who have not heard me before, this accent is for real. Although I did joke during the recall race that I was actually born in Fresno and I had cultivated this accent to give myself an air of being an ethnic minority. And I received at one point 37 letters from people asking me, how exactly did you go about changing your accent? And two of them were from Fresno, which illustrates a level of gullibility that perhaps explains why Arnold Schwarzenegger is governor. But as Ed Koch said when he lost his race in New York, the people have spoken, now the people must be punished. And we see how increasingly every candidate, whether it is Arnold Schwarzenegger or George Bush, is running on a platform of reform, because they all have pollsters, and their pollsters are telling them that the public wants reform. Therefore, they run on that platform. They govern very differently. But you may remember that George Bush ran as a reformer with results. And Arnold Schwarzenegger ran as a populist who was going to clean up housing in Sacramento and clean up especially the power of the special interests. So as it has turned out, he's taken millions from special interests and there hasn't been any cleaning up of Sacramento. But nevertheless, that is now the way everybody has to campaign. as populists, as reformers. So that's some kind of achievement, right? We don't have results yet, but at least we've changed rhetoric, which is the beginning before we get results. It's just that the public has to also recognize very clearly the difference between convincing rhetoric backed by millions of dollars and reality. And it takes a while, partly because the media are suffering from attention deficit disorder. And they're mesmerized by power. We saw that in Washington. We saw it when the media found itself embedded, not just during the war in Iraq, but before the war in Iraq and in its aftermath. And it really took the shocking pictures we've seen in the last week to really wake up the media to what is happening in Iraq, which is tragic, really, if you think of it. Sure, there have been sporadic stories and sporadically good reporting, but in general, especially on the run-up to war, which is the most important time for the media, because once you start the war, then we have all this confusing period about are you attacking the troops or are you attacking the policy? But on the run-up to the war, that's when the media should really be investigating and offering the challenges that we needed to have been offering before something as important as invading another country preemptively was actually undertaken. And in the same way here in California, we see this acceptance of what Arnold Schwarzenegger is doing, this kind of mesmerized acceptance, even though what he's doing is, first of all, completely contrary to what he campaigned on. He definitely did not campaign on cutting higher education. And we saw today the fact that everybody has somehow joined hands and said, fine, you know, cut our budgets this year in exchange for not cutting them next year. Another promise that I have no doubt will be breached. But here we are now, for the first time in California history since 1960, breaking the promise that every qualified high school student will go to college. I think that is a major moment, and it should not go unmarked. And just because the media are celebrating the fact that everybody agrees, there's nothing particularly great about agreement if you're agreeing about the wrong thing. And I don't see, in this book, Fanatics and Fools, The Game Plan for Winning Back America, I have an interlude. The book is about the November election, but I have an interlude that addresses what I believe has happened in California since Schwarzenegger became governor. And one of the problems is that we have somehow accepted the fact that it is more important to give everybody a car tax refund worth about 150 bucks, right, on average, that is more important than making sure that local governments have the money they need for police, for fire protection, even for community colleges. Part of that money is going to community colleges. So what has happened to this country when those kind of perverted priorities not only are the order of the day, but are accepted by the media and the public as the order of the day? That's what needs to be changed, and I believe that the November election is a great opportunity to address these issues, because presidential elections are really a very important moment for coming together and asking some of these fundamental questions, like what kind of a country do we want to live in? So in this book, I first address the problem of the fanatics and the fools. But then, and I think most importantly, I look at the roadmap for how we can bring about fundamental reforms and really take back America. And the second part was very much the product of my race, my short 7 weeks as a candidate, because I saw during those short 7 weeks how insufficient it is to have simply a critique of your opponent, however brilliant and justified, and better policies. What you really need is a whole alternative vision for the state or the country, a whole alternative narrative. And that's really what I'm urging in this book for John Kerry. It's not enough to have a brilliant attack of George Bush as a fanatic, surrounded by fanatics. It's not enough to have a better Medicare plan. He needs to offer the American people an alternative moral vision for this country. And the public is hungry for it. But before we go to the vision, let me just say a couple of things about the fanatics and a couple of things about the fools. I'm using the word fanatics rigorously. I'm not using it loosely. There are three main symptoms of the condition. The first one is to basically not want to be bothered by the facts. You know, your mind is made up. It doesn't matter what the evidence or the facts are. You've made up your mind. That's it. You're invading Iraq or you are cutting taxes and the fact that jobs do not follow the cuts in taxes doesn't matter. You just cut them some more. And the second symptom is the belief that somehow you have a direct line to God Almighty. And that, and I don't mean Dick Cheney. And that, therefore, it doesn't matter how nightmarish the consequences of your actions, you're okay because you're just doing the Almighty's bidding. And the third symptom is repetition, repetition, repetition. We saw that before we invaded Iraq when the president and his fellow fanatics so often told us that somehow Saddam was implicated in September 11, that 66% of the public believed it. So what about the fools? The fools are the congenitally spineless leaders of the Democratic Party who enabled the fanatics to prevail. Because the fanatics cannot prevail without the fools enabling them. And that's a very important history lesson. Thank God something happened during the Democratic primary. And the movement that was unleashed through the internet, through the sort of pent-up need for reform, led not to the victory of Howard Dean, but to the co-opting of the message of Howard Dean by every candidate except Joe Lieberman. So now there's been a bit of a spine transplant into the Democratic Party. And now we, the people, have to make sure that it holds, that it actually informs the rest of the campaign between now and November. And to that effect, Joe Trippi, who ran the Dean campaign, and I have come together and have put forward a petition to John Kerry, which is on my website, fanaticsandfools.org, and which I urge you to go and read, and if you agree, sign and circulate to your friends. And basically what the petition is saying is let George Bush own September 11 and the politics of fear. You need to own September 12 and the politics of hope. Because it was on September 12th when blood banks overflowed. People had to be turned away from ground zero because there were so many who wanted to help. There was an enormous outpouring of generosity, of money, of time. And people had really come together as a community. So it was the worst of times, but it was also the best of times. And that opportunity to come together was squandered. And George Bush called us to do nothing beyond going shopping and going to the Disney World. So now is an opportunity for John Kerry to call on us to actually be part of a greater collective undertaking than simply going shopping and simply returning to our normal lives, as the saying went. And I believe that this is the historic moment. The public is longing to be called to something greater, partly because of September 11, which did change a lot of things in this country, partly because of the threat of terrorism, partly because of what we're seeing now that the war in Iraq is coming home into our own living rooms, with the deaths of young men and women, with the gulf in sacrifice that we see, you know, between those getting multi-trillion dollar tax cuts and those losing their lives. So somehow, I really believe, and I've been going all around the country, speaking at colleges, speaking everywhere, and I am convinced that idealism is the sleeper issue of 2004. And that's why in this petition we are urging John Kerry not to run a swing voter campaign, you know, trying to appeal to the 3 or 4% he can pull away from the Republicans, slicing and dicing the message, but instead running a visionary, inspirational campaign appealing to the 50% of Americans who've given up on voting. That's an incredible amount of people. That's actually, to be specific, 100 million people who've given up on voting. And even if we can get 10% of them back, it will dramatically change our politics and it will dramatically change our country. And in order to do that, we have to offer hope and inspiration. And I absolutely believe we can do it and that this is the time to do it. And what I tell all my friends who are tempted to vote for Ralph Nader or to sit this one out is 2004 is not 2000. This is an incredibly important election. And I believe that in a way, the best way to sum it up is that our house is on fire. And when your house is on fire, it's not the best time to talk about remodeling. This is the time to put the fire out, send George Bush back to Crawford, Texas, which is what putting the fire out means. And then we need to immediately begin again in earnest the very important critical work of political remodeling. And that's where reform comes in. And both at the national level and at the state level, I think campaign finance reform is at the heart of any reform. And for me, campaign finance reform has to mean public financing of campaigns. We've seen that everything else just leads to the creation of more groups, other ways to run campaigns, either with the candidates or without the candidates. So public financing of campaigns is the way to level the playing field, to make it possible for candidates to run who are not self-financed or who are not beholden to special interests or not willing to be beholden to special interests. But at the same time, there are other electoral reforms like instant runoff voting, same-day registration, that will really open up the system. And these are also incredibly important. Specifically in California, I think, as Gloria said, we really need to address our structural problems. And for me, it starts with the corporate tax loopholes. I mean, there are corporate tax loopholes, domestic and foreign, which together with the loophole in Prop 13 about commercial property tax assessment would bring this state about $7 billion. And it is, to me, completely irresponsible and indeed immoral that we are not addressing this, given that the alternative is what's going to happen when the budget is actually unveiled this week. There are going to be between $3 and $4 billion in cuts in social services, the Healthy Families Program, other programs which are very, very essential to the lives of the poorest, most vulnerable, hardworking Californians. And I don't believe that this is a trade-off we should accept, because it's not even a question of raising taxes. Loopholes are not something that, whether you're on the right or on the left, you should countenance, because ultimately it's a way to defraud the public. And that, for me, is one of the absolutely fundamental reforms that we need to see. And it addresses again the question I raised earlier about what are our priorities. And certain things, I think, have to be off the table. Otherwise, what we're doing is cutting the rungs in the ladder of opportunity for so many young people whose lives are going to be forever changed as a result. So now let me move on to the vision part. I believe that if we're going to really fundamentally reform our state and our country, we need to appeal to what is best in everyone. You know, we are all a mixture of self-interest and generosity. And most of politics appeals to the self-interest in us. Most of politics is pandering. That's why what I'm talking about, really, we haven't seen much of since 1968 and the death of Bobby Kennedy. Indeed, John Lewis, the congressman and civil rights leader, said that when Bobby Kennedy died, something died in American politics. Something died in all of us. And we need to recapture it. We need to bring it back. And in this book, I have, this is my own copy, and you can see it's very dog-eared, and with little tabs, which are visionary statements or parts of speeches from John Kerry, who is, interestingly enough, connected to Bobby Kennedy in different ways, including the fact that, and that for me should be the narrative of the Kerry campaign, incidentally, starts on June 5th, 1968, when Kerry is coming home from Vietnam on the night that Bobby Kennedy is assassinated. And he is listening on the crackling radio what's happening at the Ambassador Hotel. And by the time he arrives and the boat docks, Bobby Kennedy is dead. And that's the beginning of his coming of age as a leader, which 3 years later leads to his testifying in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and urging his country to get out of Vietnam. I don't know if you've seen that testimony, but it's incredibly powerful. It's very compelling. It has the kind of moral clarity and fearlessness that we need to see from him right now. And that's what our petition is urging him to bring forward again. And then he quotes Bobby Kennedy's line, which it's from George Bernard Shaw, but which nevertheless Bobby Kennedy made his own. Some people see things as they are and ask why. I dream of things that never were and ask why not. And this should be a why not campaign. You know, why not access to health care for everyone? Why not good schools? Why not clean air? Why not leaders who respect us enough to tell us the truth? That is so critically important that nobody can say that we don't have these things because we don't have the money or the resources. We have the resources to spend $200 billion in Iraq, right? It's just a matter of priorities. Politics and public policy are ultimately about priorities. They're never, in a country as rich as ours, about money. So I believe that this election has to be about all that, and not just about the questions that Karl Rove and George Bush want to put it about. And if you want me to be very clear what these questions are, at the end of the book I have this section called Rallying Call, where I recount a conversation I had over Christmas with a family of Greek friends and a young 11-year-old boy, their son, who is a Bush Republican. And he said to me, Arianna, I'm going to convince you to vote for George Bush in November. So never wanting to discourage a young boy interested in politics, I said, far away, Constantine. So he said, I have two questions for you. The first is, do you want to pay more or less of your money in taxes? And the second is, do you want to fight the war on terror? So I thought to myself, wow, you know, Karl Rove really has the message down in such a simple way, so accessible, so clear that even an 11-year-old can be right on message. And then I thought to myself, instead of giving him the correct answers to these wrong questions and the correct answers, in case you're interested, how much longer do I have?
A while.
the correct answers are A, it's about time that we connected the dots between taxes and all the things that we want, like fire and police protection and good schools and clean air. Otherwise, we'll be like Arnold Schwarzenegger, who rails against taxes and goes to Washington, calls himself the collectinator because he's going to bring so much money back to Sacramento. And you wonder, where does he think this money is coming from? Movie grosses? You know, it's taxes, right? So connecting the dots is the right answer to that question of whether we want to keep more or less of our money. And in terms of the war on terror, the answer is yes, I'd like to fight the war on terror. When do we start? Because invading Iraq was not about fighting the war on terror. Indeed, it has made us less safe and less secure as a country. So the question, though, that I'm asking in the book is, what should this November election be about? It shouldn't be about the questions that Karl Rove is asking. It should be about much more fundamental questions. It should be about the key question of, isn't it about time that hardworking Americans were put first and that trickle up, not trickle down, was the order of the day? And wouldn't it be nice if we had fewer poor people every year in this country instead of having 3 million more people living in poverty since George Bush became president. So I believe that the American people are ready for these larger questions. It's just that we need to make them central to this campaign. And I remember Paul Wellstone, before he died, I asked him, what should we be looking for in a president? And he said, we should be looking for somebody to bring the best out in us. And that is very profound and very important, because our problems are not going to be solved simply by government. They're going to be solved when we all get involved in solving them. And that is what leaders can do, evoke the best in us, the way John Kennedy did with the Peace Corps, and LBJ did with VISTA, and before both of them, FDR did with the Civilian Conservation Corps. These were moments when our leaders appealed to what Lincoln called the better angels of our nature. And I truly believe this is the way to also bring back some of those 100 million people who've given up. I think this is, after all, the fundamental reform, because in any system, when you have half the people checking out, this cannot be a healthy, thriving democracy. You know, we Greeks gave you democracy. And you've basically screwed it up. Incidentally, among the 100 million people who've given up on our democracy are 22 million single women. And I'm particularly working, together with a group called Women's Voices, Women's Vote, to do everything we can to bring them back. And next week I'm going to be back on May 18, speaking at a rally for Women's Vote, together with Joan Blades, who is the co-founder of MoveOn.com. And we have some information, and we're going to leave with you for you to see if you want to come back, or tell your friends to come back, or you can go to my website, fanaticsandfools.org, and get all the information about where it is and how to get there. So the bottom line is that there is a lot we each one of us can do between now and November 2nd to make sure this is a different election, that it's not business as usual, and that the people who've given up on our system recognize it's not business as usual. And the stakes are so high that I believe that we all have the opportunity and the obligation to do everything we can, because the result of this election will irrevocably shape the 21st century. Thank you.
Thank you, Arianna Huffington. Now, do you want to stand up? Do you want to sit down? We can.
I'll sit down.
Okay, bring the mic with you. Just detach it, if you would. I know it's been a long day. Actually, you can bring the whole thing, I think, including the stand.
You know what they say, if you break it, you own it.
No, bring the whole thing with the stand, actually. It'll move. There you go. And just rip it right off of there. There we go. All right.
Wow.
So now we have a chance for the fun part, the conversation.
She only has 3,500 questions.
I have lots here. In fact, I was thinking you were talking about the collectinator and the governator and so on. We also have a friend here in Silicon Valley, Steve Wesley, and he calls himself the reforminator. So tonight we're all going to be reforminators, and we're going to talk about the federal government. We're going to talk about the state government and how we can make productive change. So I'll probably go back and forth a bit between the national scene and the California scene. Let's start off with this one. If you got to appoint the next president, who would it be?
John Kerry.
Are you sure? Not just because he's running.
No, I'll tell you why I'm saying that. Because this is the cover of my book, and as you can see, it's a chessboard. And there is only one chess piece that can move the George Bush chess piece off the chessboard, and that's John Kerry. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm not going to waste 1 ounce of my energy or brain power between now and November 2nd to do anything but making it as likely as I can, in every way I can, that John Kerry is president and George Bush is not. And it's really as simple as that. I can't even answer questions like, what if George Bush wins? My mind cannot compute. And the same way I cannot answer questions about who else could it be, because that's the reality. That's our system. Would I like to have a system that's more open? If we had instant round of voting, for example, if people wanted to vote for Ralph Nader, they could, and then the second vote would go to John Kerry, and there would be no problem at all. But we don't. So I want us all to be very realistic at the same time that we are extremely idealistic on November 2nd, because that combination is going to be lethal. And with that combination, we'll be able to see George Bush defeated, not in a toss-up election, but in a landslide for the other side.
All right. Well, we'll get to the instant runoff voting question in a few minutes, but let's stay on the presidential election for a moment. Ralph Nader, how is he going to affect the campaign this time? Will he stay in the race? Will he flame out?
I think everything depends on the kind of campaign John Kerry runs. The more visionary and inspiring his campaign, the less of a factor Ralph Nader is going to be. And the more John Kerry runs a swing voter campaign, straight down the middle, the more important of a factor Ralph Nader will be. So that's why I think what kind of campaign Kerry runs is so incredibly important.
Let's talk for a moment about Ralph Nader, a very strange guy. Lives in a room, doesn't drive a car, may have some issues related to brain chemistry. Why does the media not get on to this?
Gloria, you look so nice.
Well, there are things I know. There are things I know about. But why does the media not really focus on him as a viable candidate? Is this a person anyone would want as the president of the United States, despite the wonderful things he's done for public safety and so on?
I think the reason is that obviously nobody expects him to be the president of the United States. So that means that he doesn't have to pass the same kind of scrutiny. Mm-hmm. But I really believe that if we can convince people that voting for Ralph Nader truly means voting for George Bush, and at the same time that everybody has the power to influence the Kerry agenda, you know, that's why I wanted to have something out there that people could get involved in, mm-hmm. like the petition, because I don't think we need to feel powerless. You know, movements always influence leaders. Bobby Kennedy was transformed by the anti-war movement. You remember? The Bobby Kennedy of 68 was not the Bobby Kennedy who first entered politics. In the same way, of course, during the civil rights movement, we would never have had the Voting Rights Act when we had it not been for the movement kind of making it clear to Lyndon Johnson and to the legislators that the Voting Rights Act had to pass. And Howard Dean, you know, if you talk to friends of yours in Vermont, they don't recognize the governor they knew compared to the candidate in the primary. So we have that power. We just need to recognize it and act on it.
Let's switch to our president for the moment. After the first round of 9/11 Commission hearings and the testimony of Richard Clark, I believe his approval ratings were still somewhere in the 50s, above, you know, majority approving of his job. How do you explain his high approval ratings? Is this another Teflon president?
No, because we're seeing his approval ratings going down now. It's taking a while for the public to really recognize just how recklessly irresponsible this presidency has been. And I think that's partly because George Bush is likable, and it's also partly because they have put out this atmosphere of fear, and we have the president who keeps repeating that he's a war president, he's a war president. I think he's a culture war president myself. And that's why he's picking these wedge issues like same-sex marriage and the amendment and what was one of the very few projects that and programs that actually were funded very generously in his last budget, and that's the Healthy Marriages Initiative, which is over $1 billion to foster heterosexual marriage, you know, the kind that Britney Spears reveres. And when Wade Horn, who is responsible for administering this program, was asked, so why is this a priority? He said, because a healthy marriage makes it much more likely that children will grow up healthy and productive. Yeah, but so do schools with books. and health insurance, right? So why is fostering a healthy marriage a priority over those other things? That's what culture war presidents do. And all that has strengthened his base and has made it harder for people to see what exactly is happening behind this charade.
I haven't read your book, but I gather that part of your issue with John Kerry, as with other Democratic candidates, is the way they back away from their most idealistic views and they compromise and they try to sort of split the difference and look, you know, if not create a strong contrast between themselves and the Republican. Is that what your feeling is, and why do they do that? Is there something about the nature of political campaigns in this country that cause candidates on the Democratic side to back away from their perhaps the best contrast that they can provide to the current leadership?
Yes, I quote in the book Tom Daschle in an interview with Tim Russert, where he was asked, so if you don't like the president's tax cuts, why don't you offer a bold alternative? And he replies, we have to take it one step at a time. And I say in the book, why? Is this an AA meeting or is it a political party? And that's really been the way they've taken it, you know, one step at a time. And part of it is, I think, the dominance of polling. You know, you mentioned this crusade that Harry Shearer and I have started called Partnership for a Poll-Free America. And that's very important because polling has really undermined leadership in this country. And it has also influenced newspaper coverage. I mean, I'm sure that one of the reasons why Arnold Schwarzenegger is being covered in this way, which is really unbelievable if you really scratch the surface at what is being done, is because he has high approval ratings. One of the reasons why George Bush is now beginning to be covered in a way which is more challenging is because his approval ratings are dropping. And that is ridiculous in a free democratic country, that the media coverage and the way your opponents act are both so affected and so driven by your poll ratings, which are so transient anyway, as we're finding out.
So the media's attention deficit disorder, what exactly is that?
It's two things. One, that they cannot follow a story beyond a certain time. I mean, look at stories like Kosovo. There was a time when Kosovo dominated the front pages. CNN even had its special music, Dararam, Kosovo. Then it was recycled. It became the same music, incidentally. Dararam, Iraq. Now, Kosovo is a disaster. I don't know how many of you have been following what's happening there, but how can you? You know, you really have to work hard to find out what's happening in Kosovo, because that story was over as far as the media was concerned. The media has a way of declaring stories over. You know, and education, for example. They passed the Leave No Child Behind initiative, which is leaving millions of children behind. But as far as both parties were concerned, and somehow the media too, education was done, over. So, as Michael Kingsley said, the story in Washington is what page, the front page story, is going to be on. The most important stories are not always on the front page. In fact, often they are rarely on the front page. And then there is the obsession with trivial stories like Kobe Bryant and Scott Peterson. I don't mean that these are not important human tragedies, but they are turning our whole nation into voyeurs. I have a very simple solution, which is I go cold turkey on these stories. Like, I don't watch them. And sometimes, you know, you have to flip channels. You know, I go off from channel to channel to channel to see what else there is other than Scott Peterson or Kobe Bryant. And I do that, and sometimes all I can watch is the golf channel. I don't play golf, but...
You know, this gets to your point about the way that polls drive what we do. I was visiting with the publisher of a newspaper fairly recently, and he said, he's a new publisher, and he said, so give me some feedback. How are we doing? And I said, well, you know, all those stories about Scott Peterson, they really shouldn't be on the front page. And he said, you know, my wife says the same thing. But the day that we reported on the change of venue of the Scott Peterson trial to this area...
You see, I didn't know that.
Traffic to our website went up by 100%. So he said, kind of shrugging his shoulders, this is what we have to do. So it's the same... The popularity mm-hmm. response yes. is what drives.
Absolutely. But thank God there are alternative sources of news now with the internet, with blogs. I don't know how many of you read blogs, but the four most read blogs get as many readers as the New York Times. I have a baby blog. I've just started blogging a month ago, but I highly recommend it. It's on arianaonline.com, and it's just a great way to communicate with your readers because you just put down whatever just happened to you. I mean, I was staying in Washington at the Four Seasons Hotel, and I walk in to get my key, and who is standing by the reception desk but Ken Lay? So I immediately went and blogged about it, which, you know.
I guess that used to be called blabbing about it.
Yes, now exactly, blabbing on paper.
Well, actually, we have a question here about Ken Lay.
Perfect, you see.
Coincidentally. When will Arnold ask Ken Lay for the $9 billion he bilked us out of?
You know, it's interesting because during the height of the energy crisis, Arnold was one of the handful of Republicans who met with Ken Lay in California, and he's never kind of explained what that meeting was about. In fact, when he was asked during the recall race, he said he did not recall meeting with him. But the whole question of the energy crisis and the fact that we haven't really resolved this problem and that, in fact, now there is a possibility of more deregulation shows what short memories we have and how... Once the crisis is over, we move on and leave the problem unaddressed.
You mentioned a few minutes ago instant runoff voting. So if we can talk just for a moment about the voting process itself. There are a couple questions. Do you feel instant runoff voting would help even the field for third parties? How would you approach introducing instant runoff voting to the national elections? That's the first question. And the second, what are your thoughts regarding online voting? Is this a reality in the next election cycle?
Well, I'm in favor of every kind of voting, provided it can be verified and we have all the conditions and the strictures that we need to make sure that it cannot be tampered with. Instant runoff voting is incredibly important. I think it will open up our system like nothing.
Can you explain the system to us just
really,
a little bit?
It's really very simple. Let's go back to 2000. If we had instant runoff voting then people who voted for Ralph Nader would have had a second choice, and most of them would have voted for Al Gore. And then if Nader did not win, their votes would go to Al Gore. It's just so simple. It's so logical. And it gives you the opportunity to vote for your first choice without being accused of being a spoiler, and indeed without being a spoiler.
Question about your evolution. How did you evolve from a conservative to a progressive public figure?
Well, first of all, there has to be a statute of limitations on this question.
So the evolution has
I will answer it.
Taken place.
Because I want to remind you that when I was a Republican, I left the Republican Party in 1996, at the end of 96. When I was a Republican, Dennis Miller was still a liberal and still funny. And Michael Jackson was still black. So I hope you've forgiven me, because it was a long, long time ago. But seriously, I was always a moderate in terms of social issues like choice and gun control and gay rights. So what changed is my perception of the role of government. When I was a Republican, I really believed that the private sector would rise to the occasion and rise to the challenge of addressing our serious social problems. And then I saw firsthand that this wasn't happening. I saw how hard it was to raise money for at-risk children or homeless shelters. And the other thing that happened to me is that I got to know Newt Gingrich.
And any club that would have him...
Exactly. Should not have me, too.
That's good. That's good. There, staying on the issue of the right and the left, we have a question about religion. What's the role of the progressive religious community in this campaign of hope you talk about? Their voice seems lost in the din of fear promoted by the religious right. What about the religious progressives?
That is such an important question. I would love to meet the person who asked it because I...
Anybody want to confess to that one?
I'd love to talk to you afterwards because I'm seriously thinking about this issue. And in fact, the introduction to my book is about this issue because I believe it's very important not to cede spirituality and religion to the right. This is a very important force in our lives, in our culture. Sure, there is separation of church and state, but that doesn't mean that spirituality, spiritual value should not inform our relations with each other and be part of our conversation with each other, our public conversation, our public square. And very often, I think, progressives tend to make the mistake of believing that any expression of spirituality is somehow tainted or open to abuse. It doesn't have to be. In fact, in the introduction to my book, I quote a story that was very important to me in terms of my own understanding of politics. And that was it happened in 1993 when I was speaking at a conference of sort of Christian conservatives. And I spoke on the subject of can conservatives have a social conscience? And I was preceded by Brent Bozell, who had just finished being the finance chair of the Buchanan for President, legendarily inclusive presidential campaign. You remember Pat Buchanan speaking in Houston in 1992, giving a speech which Molly Ivins memorably said sounded much better in the original German. So Brent Bozell gave a really sort of hard-hitting speech and got a standing ovation. And I was sitting on the desk thinking to myself, A, you know, how can he and I both be Republicans? And B, where is the nearest exit? But I stood up and I spoke about the Bible and how the Bible challenges us all to treat poverty seriously and to address the moral imperative of fighting poverty. Indeed, the Bible says that we shall be judged by what we do for the least among us. And St. Luke talks about to whom much is given from him, that much more shall be expected. And I got a standing ovation. And I thought to myself, these are the same people who applauded two very, very different messages. And that's because Brent Bozell and I had appealed to different parts of their brain and their psyches. And so it's very important to remember that we cannot give up on anybody. Well, maybe on Karl Rove and Condoleezza Rice. But for a lot of people, it's just a question of what message are we putting out there? And how can we unite ourselves? You know, because ultimately, this whole idea that we're always going to be divided into red states and blue states, I mean, we don't want that. And it's also not true. You know, this division ignores the majority of people. And the majority of people are purple people. You know, no, seriously, you know, whenever you read this conventional wisdom about red states and blue states, red states and blue states come to 50% of the electorate, the likely voters. Remember, the other 50% are the purple people. There are more of them than there are of the divided people. So by bringing the purple people in, we can really dramatically change our politics and reform our country. How many times have I used the word reform? How am I doing?
You're doing well. Well, let's talk about the governor and California. And we have a bunch of questions here. What grade would you give our governor in terms of governing and keeping his campaign promises?
Well, I have here a very simple list. That is what he said, what he did. It's very simple. He said he will come in and take out all the waste from the budget, remember? He never talked about borrowing money to balance the budget or cutting anything to balance the budget. I usually really read this section because it sums up everything. Then he said that he would not cut education, remember? He said he will not take special interest money because he was independently wealthy. And it goes on and on and on. So the truth is that nobody's holding him accountable to what he said. And politicians have gotten so used to not being held accountable to what they say that they say anything. And if they have enough money to back up what they're saying with advertising, it's very easy to fool the public. But most important for me is the fact that a lot of people are hurting in California. And we need to have people speaking out for them. We need to have people raising their voices so that this does not go on without any champions for those who are hurting, especially now that the media are so cowed and so many of the Democratic leaders are simply going along.
One of our local leaders, Tom McHenry, served on the governor's transition team, and he pushed reforms at the governor in terms of including them in his platform. And I talked to Tom the other day, and he said he's still pushing, but the governor says, well, now is not the time. I'll have to take these on later. And one of the issues that has arisen is whether there should be a reform commission in California that would actually take up at a statewide level the whole list of reform issues. What do you think of this idea? What do you think about the governor's statement that now is not the time, he'll get to these later?
Well, ultimately, as we said earlier, public policy is about priorities. And for people who are not real reformers, the time is never right. In terms of a reform commission, sure. But, you know, I'm also worried about a lot of things that happen that are grandstanding. Let's take the governor's executive order on hydrogen. It was so reminiscent of what the president did with his hydrogen proposal. Remember in the State of the Union? There was this proposal that he would usher in the hydrogen economy. And often these are really substitutes for doing the right thing right now, which is using the hybrid technology that actually exists right now and therefore improving fuel efficiency standards and reducing pollution right away.
Or even keeping around the electric vehicles. I drove an EV1 until December, as did my husband, which have now been crushed and thrown
in
a landfill because the state did not maintain its clean air standards to keep on the road those cars that already existed that were completely non-polluting. But that's another topic. What's on your list of reforms for California?
Top of the list for me is closing corporate tax loopholes and fixing the commercial property tax assessment, a loophole, because they would bring in billions of dollars. And so that's our highest priority right now. And then electoral reform, instant runoff voting, and public financing of campaigns.
Couple follow-up questions on those. Someone asked, if we eliminate the corporate loopholes, the companies will relocate to India, Mexico, et cetera, and pull jobs with them. How do we prevent the loss of high-skilled jobs if we close those loopholes?
Well, first of all, we're losing high-skilled jobs with the loopholes. And secondly, this is just fear-mongering that businesses perpetuate in order to keep the loopholes. Just take Disney. They pay a dime per square acre, and you have householders living nearby that pay an enormous amount more money in property taxes. Do you think that if we actually leveled the playing field and they had to pay their fair share of taxes, they would take Disneyland and move it to Arkansas? I don't think so.
What about clean money campaign financing? This was a big element of your gubernatorial campaign.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, I offered an initiative about public financing of campaigns and clean money because I do believe it's at the heart of all reforms. And now there is a bill that's going through the assembly about that, that I'm very supportive of. We've seen it work, you know, in other states like Maine and Arizona, and it passed in Massachusetts, although they're having a lot of problems funding it.
Is there any likelihood this is really going to happen in California, that is complete public financing of campaigns?
You know, it's hard, but it's happened in other states. You know, Arizona has seen its first publicly financed governor. So it can happen. I think it's just, again, a matter of leadership and educating the public.
I know that one of the governor's reform platforms that actually was introduced in the state legislature was the moratorium on campaign donations during the final stage of the budget process in the state legislature. Do you know what's happening with that provision?
Well, he did return some money that he got during the budget negotiations. You know, these are itsy-bitsy little initiatives, and nothing really fundamentally changes. It reminds me a little bit of school uniforms in the Clinton years. You know, I'm not saying that school uniforms are not a good thing. I have two daughters, and I'm very happy they wear school uniforms so we don't have to spend hours choosing the perfect tank top. So I'm sure not receiving campaign donations in the final stages of budget negotiations is a good thing, but it's a very small thing. And really, what I'm talking about, both in this book and as I go around the country, is that this is the time to talk about big things. And if not now, with everything that's happening in our world, when? And that's why I'm hoping that you can all join me in signing this petition, and as the petition says, asking John Kerry to go big, ask more, you know, ask more of us, because George Bush has made this Faustian bargain with the American people. He's effectively told us, you can't expect too much of me, but then I'm not going to ask anything of you. And Kerry needs to change that bargain.
Time for our last question. And this is probably one on which there's also a statute of limitations, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Do you presently have any political aspirations?
No. I consider myself an activist journalist, and as you said in your introduction, as well as writing my columns and my books, I love to take action to make the things I believe in more likely. And so running for office was an expression of that. And right now, I love being back on my day job.
Thank you so much, Arianna
Thank
Huffington.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Very nice. Thank you. Keep it up. Keep provoking and advocating for reform. We really appreciate it.
Thank you
all for attending tonight's program with Arianna Huffington, national syndicated columnist and author. Thank you to the James Irvine Foundation for supporting this Voices of Reform program this evening. Thank you to our audience here in Santa Clara and our audience on the radio. Now, this meeting of the nation's largest public affairs forum is adjourned.